I should perhaps tell you a little bit about the title. The first part of it was made up by my wife, who thought that I needed something in order to get people to actually come to the talk. And the second, more boring part was made up by myself. But at least it shows a little bit more about what the talk will be about. I'm going to try to describe how information privacy has been assured throughout history and why these techniques never seem to work. And I'm going to talk about protection of privacy. Let me first of all tell you what a definition of it could be. This is the one I've taken from the Oxford English Dictionary, which in Canada we can see to be the Dictionary of English. Sorry about that, Barbara. And it says that in their definition, they say it is the state or condition of being alone, undisturbed, or free from public attention as a matter of right or choice, freedom from information or intrusion. Well, actually, it's a good deal more than that. And what I'm going to try to do is to convince you about that by first of all seeing if I can make this work. So privacy actually has a number of dimensions, which I'll talk about here relatively briefly. There's privacy of the body, of course, and that, of course, includes our private parts. And sometimes you may find them posted on the internet if you have maybe made somebody angry. There's privacy of the home, and it's often intruded by telemarketing people. And these days, also by people who claim they're taking surveys. Never answer these surveys. They're probably after something other than what they say they are. And there's other kinds of intrusions, like break and enter sort of things. Privacy from surveillance. There's closed-circuit TV everywhere these days. I get into a cab at the Toronto airport, and there's a camera on me. Used to have that. And there's privacy from eavesdropping, wireless devices. Although, these days, it's kind of hard. People don't seem to worry about privacy using wireless devices. Have you noticed that? You go into any kind of place, and there's even on a streetcar or something like that, and there's somebody talking at the top of his lungs on a cell phone about intimate details of his life that you do wish you weren't hearing. And then, of course, there's finally this one. This is the one I'm going to talk about, and that's information privacy. This is really essentially what the major theme of what I'm going to say will be about. The thing I want to point out to you is that privacy is more important than you think, and it's being eroded steadily, as you can see, in all these different ways. So let's take a simple example of intrusion and information privacy. We're all aware of something called spam. Spam is essentially unsolicited electronic mail, which is sent to a large number of individuals simultaneously and usually for advertising purposes. Most of it is devoted to enhancing your private parts. The origin of the word is obscure, but it's said to have something to do with dropping a food product into a fan. There are cures, but it has certainly become a ubiquitous plague. There are cures, but so far legislators and ISPs have been reluctant to do much about it. It is possible to limit it, but there's too much money to be made. Fortunately, for the most part, it's just a nuisance, and it's easily dealt with by a judicial use of the delete button. But it does have a dark side in the sending of inappropriate material to young people. The porn industry has thrived on the internet, but I'm back to private parts again. So maintain your spam filters and be vigilant in examining what comes into your children's computers. My next example is a little bit more dangerous. It's called phishing. That's phishing with a capital P, rhymes with T and stands for trouble. And this is the act of soliciting information from you that can be used to part you from your money, or even worse, even your entire identity. You probably may see it on your computer. Something will come up. The Royal Bank of Canada will claim that your account has perhaps been compromised. And in order to determine that, they want you to send them some information. This, of course, is not the Royal Bank of Canada at all. It's somebody who's scamming you. And if you are wise, you do not ever fill out anything like that over the internet, because they're not after what they say they're after. There are other ways of doing this besides, of course, over the internet. There are low-tech ways of doing this, called dumpster diving and shoulder surfing. The one thing I want you to be aware of is that It's estimated that one out of 125 email messages is devoted to phishing. That's a lot. And it does seem to work. And it's because mass mailings on the internet are cheap. They can afford to do this. So the question may be now, how safe do you think your secrets are? Well, first of all, what do you think is a secret? Here's what the OED says. Some fact, affair, design, action, etc., the knowledge of which is kept to oneself or shared only with those whom it concerns or to whom it has been confided. Well, I would like to say here that there are some items that you should regard as secret from now on. Here they are. And they don't seem like secrets. Your address, date of birth, social insurance number, or social security number if you're from down below, and your mother's maiden name. Those are secrets. Don't let people know them, especially over the internet. The reason is that that's all that's required, along with your name, for someone to assume your identity. Not very much. Now, on the average, it will take you 600 hours of work to reestablish your identity. Once you have determined it's been stolen. And it takes between 3 or 4 years to fully recover. And I think that also means your nervous system recovers. So it's a very, very big problem. And in this slide, I'll give you just a slight indication. These are kind of old statistics, but the Canada loss in 2002 was $8 million. And in 2003, it went up to $14 million. It has continued to go up. And in the States, it's in the billions. It's really a very, very serious problem. And unfortunately, with the exception of the state of California, not much has been done about it. And one of the things that could be done about this, and I would like you to talk to your MPs, if you ever see them, about this, and that is try to get legislation passed that forces companies who've had a breach to say that they've had a breach of their security. So far, there is no such legislation. If I am dealing with, say, the Bank of Montreal, and somehow or other the Bank of Montreal manages to lose, and it does not just mine, it's going to be a whole lot of people's information, it gets hacked. They are not obliged to inform anyone. Now, if they get hacked and it ends up costing me money, I go to the Bank of Montreal and say, look, I want my money back. They'll give me my money back. They don't mind losing that amount of money. What they don't want to have is knowledge from other people that they've been hacked. And yet, if you think about this carefully, you are still exposed. Just because you've had this problem solved by the Bank of Montreal, you have no idea where else that information has gone. And there are clearinghouses on the internet that sell people's identities and personal information. You can go to these clearinghouses and you can buy this stuff. It's an interesting world out there. It's getting worse and worse all the time. Well, this is just sort of to give you an idea of how serious this problem is becoming, and it's going, as I say, get much worse. In spite of the importance of keeping our private parts private, we think nothing about revealing them each time we conduct a purchase over the internet. How many of you ever bought a book from Amazon.com? Or chapters.ca. I have. Lots of us have. And what do? Well, you give away one of your private parts, eh? Your credit card number. And you don't think much about it. But actually, you'd probably like to keep that secret, wouldn't you? You wouldn't want it to be hacked. And most of the time, it's not going to be hacked. A lot of these companies are very good. Certainly Amazon.com is very, very careful about the security measures that it takes. So, and how do they do it? Well, it's done through the use of cryptography, which brings me to the main topic of my talk. And cryptography is the study of the design and analysis of mathematical techniques that ensure secure communication in the presence of malicious adversaries. That's essentially what it is. It's an essential component of any installation in which secure communication is needed. And its use goes back to Julius Caesar, as far as we know. At least it's documented back that far. And it almost certainly is even earlier. Unfortunately, this time I have to get a little technical. But I haven't gotten very technical so far, and this is not really all that technical. But let me just give you a bit of an idea of what cryptography is about. Now, I'm going to do this with the classical Alice and Bob. It used to be A and B many years ago, but it was decided that it would change to Alice and Bob. And it has been that way ever since. I go far enough back that I can remember that when it was A and B. So what you got here is the following situation. You've got a secure channel and an unsecure channel. The unsecure channel is cheap. It could be a cell phone, could be the internet, anything. And it's a way by which Alice and Bob want to communicate. Now the idea here is the following. Both Alice and Bob have access to a large number of mathematical transformations that will all belong to the same family. And they are indexed by a certain number. So that when I know this number, and say I'm Alice, and Bob knows this number, then they can communicate. Because these transformations are invertible, as long as each knows this important number. So this is what happens. Alice selects from among these large number of transformations a particular one. These transformations are applied to the text and renders the text unreadable. Now, if all we want to do is to render the text unreadable, cryptography would be easy. But there is this desire to have the person at the other end be able to read what you're sending. So Bob has to be able to read it. And so what Bob needs to know is which transformation Alice selected. That information is called the key. And the key is sent over a secure channel. Now, Eve is the eavesdropper. Eve is the person who wants to intercept the information that's going between Alice and Bob. Okay? And the idea is that Eve will not be able to access the secure channel by which the key is being delivered. Now, most of my students, when I mention this little model to them, will say something like the following. Well, if you've got a secure channel, why don't you just use that to send the messages and forget about all this BS? And the answer is simply that the secure channel is very expensive, and you just don't want to use it very often. Okay, so this is essentially the idea of cryptography in what is called one-key cryptography. Now, I want to talk next a bit about cryptanalysis. Cryptanalysis is the process by which Eve, on receiving some ciphertext, determines the original message without prior knowledge of the key. In other words, Eve can, from the information that she is getting across this channel, work out what that information is and figures out usually what the key is. This is when successful, we say that Eve has broken the system. We all know there's simple systems that you can break. There's in the newspapers, there's usually a crypto system that you break, crypto quotes or something like that, and you do this all the time. It's pretty simple to do. But cryptology, and I should point out that cryptology is the study of both cryptography and cryptanalysis. There are many examples throughout history which illustrate the need for strong cryptography. Indeed, bad cryptography in extreme cases can lead to the death of the user of the system, which I will talk about in a moment. But with regard to cryptology, I think we should always bear in mind the famous quote of Edgar Allan Poe, which is this. Few persons can be made to believe that it is not quite an easy thing to invent a method of secret writing which shall baffle investigation. That's true. Most people think it's easy. It's not. And the other thing is, yet it may be roundly asserted that human ingenuity cannot concoct a cipher which human ingenuity cannot resolve. A few years ago, people thought that Poe was wrong. But now they're beginning to realize he was probably right about that. So this is just something that one should always keep in mind. Okay, so what I want to do now is to talk about a particular example of bad cryptography. And this is the sad story of Mary, Queen of Scots. Now, in a really complicated sequence of events, Mary had been ejected from Scotland and found herself imprisoned in a sequence of English castles until she finally ended up in the country estate of Chartley. She was there, held incommunicado, and essentially under house arrest. Sir Francis Walsingham, who was Queen Elizabeth's chief minister, was really unhappy about Mary. He was extremely suspicious of her and certainly was eager to get rid of her permanently. And this was because of the prior incidents suggested that she might be used in a conspiracy to overthrow the government and establish her as the Catholic sovereign of England. The key word in that sentence is Catholic. Walsingham was a really quite rabid Protestant, and he saw any possibility of a Catholic sovereign of England as probably his death warrant. So he wanted to make sure that Mary would never be there. And it's important to understand that Mary had an extremely good claim to the English throne. She was a direct descendant of Henry VII, and she had never been declared illegitimate. Elizabeth had. So this was enough to make Walsingham nervous. In fact, Walsingham even managed to get inserted into the Act of Association, the clause, which is very outrageous by our way of thinking today. And it said that if any such conspiracy was exposed, the individual on whose behalf it was being done, even if that individual were unaware of the plot, would still be guilty of treason. Well, I'm not sure that Walsingham actually believed that this would get Mary on the block, because I think he understood that Elizabeth would never sign the death warrant, not with something like that. But he had another purpose in doing that, and that was to make Mary desperate. He'd also, Walsingham, had established an efficient organization of secret intelligence which employed several agents. One of these was Thomas Phillips, who was a master of cryptanalysis for the time. Walsingham's opportunity came in 1586, when Anthony Babington, a former page of Mary's, began organizing a plot to have courtiers assassinate Elizabeth, incite a general Catholic uprising in England, and install Mary as queen. This plan needed the acquiescence of Mary, which meant that Babington had to find a way of communicating with her. And this was achieved through the recruitment of a former seminarian named Gilbert Gifford, who was used as a messenger. And Gifford discovered a method of smuggling letters to Mary in a beer keg. I wrote this for Big Rock University. Mary was very careful to encrypt the correspondence, and she also insisted that letters sent to her be encrypted. However, she was completely unaware that Gifford was also acting as a double agent. He offered his services to Walsingham, and Walsingham accepted them with alacrity. Thus, all the correspondence between Babington and Mary was being delivered to Walsingham and cryptanalyzed by Phillips. Though Walsingham was reading all Mary's traffic, he did not act immediately. He waited until Mary, through her correspondence, had involved herself so deeply in the plot that there was simply no way out. Then he pounced. And Mary was tried in a Star Chamber proceeding, found guilty, and after Elizabeth signed her death warrant, was executed on February the 8th of 1587. So this is sort of a sad story that sort of shows that you should be careful about what cryptographic systems you're using, especially when your life depends on it. Well, I think you can see that naturally the better the techniques are employed in cryptanalysis, the more cryptographers are inspired to develop better systems. In the past, the crucible of cryptanalysis has been war. Not necessarily true anymore, but it still has a lot of truth in it. And while often deliberately understated because of the need of security, the contributions of cryptanalysts to the war efforts have been enormous. The problem is we just don't know about it. People don't talk about it. For example, the breaking of the Zimmermann telegram in World War I by British cryptanalysts was instrumental in bringing the Americans into that war. Arthur Zimmermann was the German foreign minister who, in his telegram, was offering Mexico an alliance with Germany in return to the Mexican rule of Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. When the contents of the telegram were revealed to the American public, there was an enormous uproar in Congress, which rapidly led to the declaration of war. And, of course, once that happened, it wasn't that much after that that the World War I was over. Toward the end of that war, Major Joseph O. Milbourne, head of the U.S. Army Signal Corps Research and Engineering Division, took an earlier idea by Gilbert Vernon and invented an unbreakable cryptosystem. People often ask me if there is such a thing as an unbreakable code or cryptosystem. And there is. This particular system, which is called the one-time pad, was given a rigorous proof of security by Claude Shannon in the 1940s. And this is when Shannon really began to develop part of his development of what today is a very important subject in in which involves cryptography and many other things, information theory. The basic idea here is to use a key which is random. As long as the message being sent, and as long as the message, and used only once. So let me try to give you an idea of why this works. It's pretty simple. Here. Can anybody cryptanalyze that? What's that say? That's only three letters. Can't get it? Why not? The reason is fairly simple. Even assuming that this represents a symbol by symbol transformation, there's just too many possibilities. That could be any number of three letter words. You can't figure out which one it is. That's why the one time pad works. Essentially, there are just too many different ways of decrypting, and therefore, there's no way of knowing which is the right one. That's how it works. There it is, XMP. It's not encrypted. Now, it's Herbert O. Yardley, who was the head of the newly created cryptologic section of the Military Intelligence Division, MI8, who really animated the American cryptographic mission. He got rid of the American schoolboy codes and ciphers, as he called them, and organized very effective attacks on enemy ciphers. After the war, he persuaded the Secretary of State to institute a permanent organization for code and cipher investigation and attack. This became known as the American Black Chamber, and was to provide very useful intelligence to the State Department until 1929. What happened in 1929, you ask? In 1928, Herbert Hoover was elected. And Herbert Hoover appointed a man named Henry L. Stimson to be the new Secretary of State. Stimson was a rather priggish individual who regarded the activities of the Black Chamber as a dirty business, and uttered what in the annals of cryptology is probably the silliest statement ever made. Gentlemen do not read each other's mail. He withdrew all funding for the Black Chamber, and Yardley was thrown out of work at the beginning of the Depression. This was to have severe consequences for the American cryptologic effort, because Yardley could not find a job. And therefore, he did what everybody who can't find a job does or something. He decided to write a book. And this book was called The American Black Chamber, and it quickly became a bestseller, particularly for a book this technical. It had sales of almost 18,000, and twice that in Japan, for reasons that become clear. So in this book, Yardley thoroughly described how the American Black Chamber had broken all of Japan's important ciphers, and that they had indeed been reading Japan's mail. So the book naturally fanned anti-Western feeling in Japan at a very bad time, and more importantly, from the perspective of the cryptanalyst, undoubtedly contributed to Japan's decision to change over to the use of rotor machines for the encryption of their diplomatic correspondence. A rotor machine is a mechanism that makes use of a set of revolving code wheels, and the greater the number of these wheels, the more secure the system. It produces what's called a stream cipher. The important thing you need to know about that is that each time the character is encrypted, it's encrypted differently. So the letter A may be encrypted as B one time, and then the next time it comes out as Z or something like that. So that's one of these things that became very, very effective as an instrument for mechanizing encryption, and it dominated cryptographic thinking until the early 70s. So even until relatively recently, rotor machines were being used. And when the rotor machines began to go out of fashion, the guys who were really into them were really unhappy. They thought that the rotor machines were the cat's ass. Okay, the most famous of the rotor machines is the Enigma, which was used by the German government throughout the Second World War. The early three-wheel-only model was broken by three Poles, who until very recently had not received the attention their amazing achievement merits. In 1938, There. That is the only monument that I know of that was ever erected to cryptanalysts. And that is in Warsaw, Poland, and it's not easy to find. It's not mentioned in the tourist brochures, but a friend of mine took me to that, and I was able to get that photograph. In 1938, the Germans changed the model to one which has a set of 5 code wheels, from which the operator chose 3. This completely defeated any further Polish cryptanalytic effort. However, war was coming very quickly. And so the Poles got these 3 guys out of the country. The last thing they wanted to do was to have these guys captured by the Gestapo. But they actually, when they were out of the country, they went to France, and they talked to British and French researchers in cryptography, and their approach was very helpful to them later on. In fact, at this time, the British government, it's called the Government Code and Cipher School, very understated way of calling this, the people who are looking at breaking ciphers, was moved from Bomb Vulnerable London to Bletchley Park, which I'm sure you're familiar with, in August of 1939. Here were assembled during the course of the war some of the most brilliant minds of the UK, among them Bill Tutte, Gordon Welshman, and Alan Turing, who was about to be treated extremely shabbily by the government he worked so hard to protect. They began working on breaking a new Enigma model and succeeded in just over a year's time. One of the innovative ideas of the Poles mentioned earlier was to enlist special purpose machines to help in their code breaking efforts. This idea was conceived by Marian Rejewski while members of his group were eating a kind of dessert called bombi, and later such machines were called bombs. It was in Bletchley Park that this idea was refined much further, in particular in trying to break a new German cipher called Fisch. It was after the German Zegefisch, which means sawfish, I believe, a name that the Germans used for one of the systems employing the cipher. As a very important one of these systems, named Tunny, keeping with the fish theme, by B. Bletchley Park, made use of 10 rotors. The bombs had to be very much larger and utilized many vacuum tubes. In fact, they were using so many vacuum tubes at one point the people who were looking after ordnance supply was wondering whether they were firing them at the enemy. But and if you think about it, these machines are quite large and they use a lot of these tubes, and you may have heard about the ENIAC, and how the ENIAC would only go for a short period of time before a tube would burn out. And they had the same kind of problems here. They sort of solved it a little bit by learning that you just don't turn them off. It's turning them on that will burn out the tubes. So just leave them. Well, ultimately, these bombs evolved into a later model called Colossus. Colossus was constructed in 1943 and was in many ways an electronic computer, and is considered today to be an ancestor to the modern digital computer. The Fisch decrypts provide vital information for the planning and execution of the D-Day invasion of Normandy in 1944. And a legacy of this has been the continued use to this day of Fisch-themed names for crypto systems. Well, let's return back to some of the American efforts. We've gone to England, let's go back to the American efforts. Meanwhile, back in the U.S., the Americans have established from the ashes of the Black Chamber and other existing cipher services the Signals Intelligence Service. This is headed by now General Joseph Milbourne. The service succeeded in breaking some very important Japanese ciphers, in particular Purple. Purple was the major diplomatic cipher used by the Japanese. And its breaking was a real tour de force, and it was accomplished through the Herculean efforts of one of the greatest of the American cryptanalysts, William Friedman. He was ordered by Milbourne in 1939 to devote all his efforts to this job and succeeded within 18 months at the considerable cost of his then and future mental health. He had a nervous breakdown as a result of this, and he never really recovered. Unfortunately, the intelligence provided by the Purple Intercepts was neither properly interpreted nor properly distributed for the Americans to prepare for the Pearl Harbor attack. They kind of knew it was coming, somebody, but wasn't too sure, and the information didn't get to the right people at the right time. The U.S. Navy employed the largest cryptographic branch among the U.S. military services, called OP-20G. Japan's Navy was rather conservative, imagine that, a conservative Navy, and did not rely on cipher machines, but rather codes in the old sense. This, combined with Japan's inability to administer effectively The territory it rapidly accumulated after Pearl Harbor gave the Navy crypt analysts, notably Lieutenant Commander Joseph Rochefort, the knowledge and time needed to break the main Japanese cipher system, JN-25. This was the Japanese flag officer system. Now, there's a general tenet in cryptography that says that no cryptographic system should be vulnerable to an adaptive attack. An adaptive attack is the following. It's an attack that makes use of information previously acquired to obtain new information from the sender, and so on, until the system is broken. Now, here is an example of an adaptive attack that was used back in World War II. A very famous example of such an attack was the determination of the location of what would become a famous battle in 1942. The commander-in-chief of the Imperial Japanese Navy, Isoroku Yamamoto, developed a plan to attack and occupy Midway Island in the Pacific. This would have been a disaster for the Americans, but fortunately for them, they were now able to read the JN-25 intercepts, in which the instructions for this invasion were encrypted by the Japanese Admiralty. Thus, they knew about a big enemy operation, but unfortunately did not know where it was going to take place, except that it was encoded as AF. It was suspected through some complicated reasoning that AF was Midway Island, but the brass was totally unconvinced by this sophistry. And, well, they didn't have many assets, right? They had only a few things left after Pearl Harbor, and so they wanted to be very, very careful about what they were doing. Mostly, though, they had their carriers. The carriers were not really harmed during the Pearl Harbor invasion. It was one of the great mistakes of the Japanese. Well, what they did was the following. An encrypted message was sent to the American garrison on Midway Island. It was asking them to broadcast back in the clear that the water distillation facility had broken down. Sure enough, an intercepted Japanese cryptogram sent a few days later stated that AF was having trouble with its water distillation plant. Gotcha! Fully armed now with the information that they needed, the Americans were prepared for the Japanese attack. The resulting engagement is regarded by almost all military historians as a turning point in the Battle of the Pacific. This is what makes cryptography fascinating. How can we protect our communications against these kinds of attacks? And always bear in mind, too, that a good cryptosystem must resist an attack by its inventor. If I can break my cryptosystem, it's crummy. Well, cryptologic work continued throughout World War II and made a significant number of contributions to the eventual Allied victory. By the end of the war, cryptology had been revolutionized. No longer were ciphers hand-coded. Machines held sway. Furthermore, cryptanalysis had been formalized, and many important discoveries were made concerning how to design ciphers that were very difficult to break. Thus, the war left three important legacies: the vital importance of cryptology for ensuring national security, the need to mechanize ciphers, and the need to establish agencies devoted to protecting government information systems and producing foreign signals intelligence information. In the U.S., this ultimately led to the establishment of the National Security Agency. This agency so frequently vilified in current TV programs, who know very little about what they do, which, of course, is exactly what the National Security Agency wants them to know. NSA, never say anything. In the U.K., this is GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters in Cheltenham. And in Canada, we now finally have the Communication Security Establishment. And there are, in any other country, you will find these kinds of agencies. And now, unfortunately, begins a black hole in our knowledge. The history up to now is pretty well known, up to that point, anyway. Everything that's appeared in the maw of the security organizations to be classified for a very long time. In fact, it was even worse than this. For example, the U.S. and its much larger sphere of influence, much larger sphere of influence, any attempt to produce a commercial cipher was vigorously opposed by NSA. And such was the agency's power that ultimately such work would be suppressed. This damaged the American efforts to develop a crypto industry enormously. Indeed, NSA actually tried to suppress the publication of what became a very influential book called The Code Breakers. This is a massive work by David Kahn, consisting of 1,100 pages, describing the unclassified history of cryptology from the earliest times until the time of publication. It also contained the most complete description of the activities of the NSA that had ever been compiled. The situation changed dramatically in the 1970s. And it all began with IBM, Big Blue. In 1971, IBM hired a very bright cryptographer named Horst Feistel into its Watson Research Center at Yorktown Heights. In those days, if you were hired there, you got to do what you wanted, just as long as you did something. And what Feistel wanted to do was develop a crypto system. And his reason for working on this was to protect government, not to protect government secrets, or diplomatic dispatches, but instead to protect people's privacy. In particular, he wanted to protect computer databases, or personal information from people who might want to steal it, to create dossiers on individuals. Yeah, that would be a pretty good thing for IBM to be able to say to its customers, right? So you've got this really good crypto system that is protecting your customers. In a bit of a pun, Feistel's cipher was called Lucifer. It was first implemented as a project devoted to a cash point system for Lloyd's of London. This is the ancestor of the modern ATM that we all use today. For wider application, Lucifer was modified and strengthened, and the new version became known as DSD1. However, IBM was not the only institution aware of the vital need for information security. That view is also shared by the National Bureau of Standards, NBS, the government agency responsible for establishing industry standards. The NBS believed that digital protection should be centered in a single system, one that had been thoroughly tested and made available to all. And ultimately, IBM submitted DSD1 to the NBS, where it became known as the Data Encryption Standard, DES. But now that it was to be a government-issued cryptographic standard, it was necessary that it receive the imprimatur of NSA. And after it survived this process, the original 64-bit key got pared down to 56. For a real BS reason. But that wasn't, of course, the reason. And DES was certified as a cryptographic standard in 1977 and remained so until 2004. That's a long time. And when it was replaced by the, in that time, it was replaced by the 128-bit key AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard. And its release marked the beginning of the end of NSA's monopoly of cryptography in the U.S., the DES. I should point out that AES was done totally differently. The process by which AES was derived was completely public. Solicitations were made through all over the planet for the system, and that system was selected by people who had nothing whatever to do with any security agency, and it is used to this day, and it's still a very powerful system. The next blow to NSA's cryptographic hegemony was the invention of public key or two-key cryptography. This was a triumph of academic cryptographic research. The idea was put forward in a very important paper by Diffie and Hellman in 1976, but they had no example of such a system. It was just an idea. However, within a year, Ravesh Shamir and Edelman at MIT produced such an example. The system is called RSA today, and it's still in use. In fact, I'd say it's used more now than it's ever been. It's even used in cell phones. In a 2K system, each communicant has a private key and a public key. The public key is recorded in a public publicly accessible directory. So I have a public key. I put it in a directory. And Barbara wants to talk to me. And so what she does is she looks up my key in that directory. She sends me a message. Now, I have a private decryption key that no one else has. But when I use this on what she has sent to me, I can read my mail. But nobody else can. Notice this is a different thing. There's no need to move a key between two communicants. Very nice idea. The simple idea is permitted secure communication over the internet. It must be pointed out that this idea in RSA had been discovered by some researchers at GCHQ just a few years prior to the discovery by the academic community, but the work was classified. And because it was classified, no one became aware of it until 1997, when GCHQ allowed publication of this information. Of course, it was too late then, and they ensured that credit for these discoveries would always be associated with the Americans who had discovered them. The other bad thing about it, of course, was that no one ever got any idea of how these things could be used, because it just sat there in the security agency's classified bin, and no one ever looked at the stuff much again. Here are some services that are provided by two-key cryptography. And these are, a lot of these are things that you cannot get from one-key cryptography, the conventional thing that I mentioned earlier. Confidentiality, of course, you can do that by any method. But data integrity, it's assuring that data has not been altered by unauthorized means. Data origin, authentication, entity authentication, and non-repudiation. All of these can come about as a result of two-key cryptography. So what was NSA's reaction to this? Well, they weren't very unhappy about the prospect of losing their monopoly on cryptographic ideas and devices. And they responded by trying to suppress publication of the RSA system. And they did this by waiving ITAR. ITAR is the International Traffic in Arms Regulations Code at MIT, and threatening all kinds of dire legal action. ITAR essentially controls the export of munitions. And in the United States, cryptographic devices are considered to be munitions. At this point, the authors of RSA, all they wanted to do was distribute a technical memo to people who had learned about RSA from a column written by Martin Gardner in Scientific American. Gardner, who had a large reading audience, had been informed about RSA by Rivest in order to get some feedback concerning the security of the system. All Rivest wanted to do was to see if other people knew whether there was a way of breaking this. He wasn't sure. He didn't know about that much about these things. The article was entitled, "A New Cipher That Takes Millions of Years to Break," and essentially spilled the beans about the new cipher. It described the basic idea and provided from the discoverers of RSA a challenge cipher that they considered impossible to break. This, however, did not stop NSA from trying to suppress any further publication concerning the discovery. Finally, after a great deal of huffing and puffing by NSA, the senior administration at MIT concluded that the agency didn't have a legal leg to stand on, and they did something absolutely remarkable for a senior administrative official in a university. They authorized the distribution of the memo. They didn't cave in. Maybe MIT can get away with that. Security of RSA, like the security of almost all commercially available cryptosystems, is based upon the presumed difficulty of a certain mathematical problem. In the case of RSA, this is the integer factorization problem. Take two big primes, multiply them together. Can you figure out what the primes are, only seeing the product? And it turns out that this is a hard problem. But recently, a little over a year ago, a 200-digit number was factored. So we're making progress on these things. It's important to recognize that no rigorous mathematical proof of security is ever given for any of these modern systems. The difficulty of these systems' problems is usually established anecdotally through frequent and unsuccessful attempts by specialists to provide solutions to them. Indeed, several problems thought to be very difficult, such as the integer factorization problem, have since been shown to be considerably less intractable than previously believed. I should point out that all these systems that we have would succumb to a quantum computer attack, if anybody ever builds a quantum computer. One of the strongest of the new systems is ECC, elliptic curve cryptography. And this is based on the presumed but still unproved difficulty of what is called the elliptic curve discrete logarithm problem. It's a difficult problem in a relatively new area of mathematics called algebraic geometry. And in the complete turnaround, NSA has recommended that ECC, a system discovered outside the fence — that's the expression they use. Inside the fence means it's part of NSA. Outside the fence, be used in a growing number of government communication applications because of its strength and efficiency, and also because it is included in an increasing number of standards and protocols. And a local company here called Certicom has managed to get NSA to buy from them the licensing rights, and they paid $25 million U.S. for those rights to Certicom. Now, no discussion of modern cryptography would be complete without mentioning PGP, pretty good privacy. This system was invented by Phil Zimmerman and named in honor of Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery. If any of those you know about Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion, there's a movie out now. And the idea of PGP was to have a public key, private key encryption system for every man. It was first released in 1991. This was freeware and made available — it has since been improved considerably over that time. It was freeware and made available over the internet to anyone who wanted to ensure the privacy of his communications. Although Zimmerman was subjected to much FBI harassment and a grand jury investigation, he was never charged with any wrongdoing. And this marked the end of NSA's ability to control the distribution of cryptographic products in the U.S. There was only one thing bad that happened to poor Zimmerman, and that is that he discovered that Al-Qaeda had used PGP. in organizing, in helping to organize the 9/11 attack. And he cried when he found that out. That was not, he never thought that that would be the case. Also, I should point out that Al-Qaeda also used low-tech a lot. FedEx, great way to send information. Well, Paul Thichten seems to be true for modern techniques just as it was for the old ones. The difference is that the amount of time that's required to break the systems is very long. And even when this happens, all one has to do to frustrate the cryptanalyst is to make the key larger. Thus, it seems that our modern techniques for encrypting are very secure. So, what then is the problem of protecting our private parts? Simply put, it has to do with implementation. We always make the assumption that the endpoints are secure. We worry about the communication channel. But of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Consider the following hierarchy. Here we are. Here it is, down here. The cryptographic tool is pretty stably anchored in this ladder. But the intermediate rungs are considered less so. So you've got the cryptographic tool, you've got a protocol, you've got an implementation, you've got the administration of the system, and then at the very, very top, you've got Joe Idiot User. And he is the weakest link in this whole thing. That's you and I, folks. And there's little we can do about it because our very humanity causes it. Consider a very simple thing. A private part we all have. Our password. Computer password. What gives us access to the machine. In order to remember it, we associate it with things that we know, like a child's birth date or a pet's name. However, this greatly restricts its secrecy. And making it fairly easy to guess. To prevent this, certain installations, they get very clever, and they insist that passwords conform to a certain number of conditions. They must contain at least 8 characters. Must contain 1 numeric character, must contain 1 uppercase letter, must contain a non-alphabetic, non-numeric character, etc. All of this is very good, except for one little thing. How the hell do I remember it? Well, I write it down, thereby making it totally vulnerable. Aha. And in many cases, it's even worse than this. Many sites know that you might forget your password, so they want to ensure that you're able to communicate. After all, that's their business. If you can't communicate with them, then there's no business going on. So you've forgotten your password. How do you do this? Well, you always see this single thing, forget your password? Well, what do they do? Well, they ask you a detail at the very beginning about your family that you have previously answered when you first logged onto the site. In NSERC, it is your father's middle name. Now think about this for a minute. That's one password to rule all of your passwords on that site. And not only that, if something could be easily found by any quick genealogical study on this, which you could do on the machine, of you. As Homer Simpson would say, boop. Anyway, let me just conclude with Walt Kelly's famous observation. We have met the enemy, and he is us. Clearly, the price of surrendering our humanity in order to ensure secure communication is just too high. What would we have to say that would be of sufficient interest to protect? It's because we have private parts that we experience such difficulty in protecting them. But this should certainly not deter us from making the attempt. In the end, we can't win this game, but we can certainly provide speed bumps along the way, and therefore not try to lose. Thank you very much for your attention.